This is Neil Ross, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
I got better things to do tonight than die.
Hello and welcome to GeekCast Radio. This is yet another one of our interviews here on GeekCast Radio Network. I'm, of course, TFU and Mike. Joining me is Steve Megatron. Hello.
Hello.
And for the first time in 3 years, we welcome back that roller derby announcer, Mr. Neil Ross.
And the ladies are off on the bank track, and into the lead goes, I can't remember any of their names. Isn't that sad? Hi, everyone. Has it really been 3 years?
2015 was the first time we interviewed you with my buddy Optimus Solo.
Yep. Seems like only yesterday.
I wasn't sure how far back it was. I thought it was like 2016, 2017, but July 30th, 2015.
Time flies, man.
Yep.
The older you get, the faster it goes. Trust me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So Neil has written a book and done an audio version of it. Vocal Recall, A Life in Radio and Voiceovers. Wow. This is amazing.
Well, I hope so. It's never having written a book before, never having thought that I would ever write a book.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders, is one delusional? Is there anything in there that anybody would even want to read? You lose all trace of objectivity after a certain point, and you just put it out there and hope for the best.
Yeah. Now, when did you decide to do this?
Well, it grew out of me attempting to write a monologue. I did an appearance here in Los Angeles with Rob Paulson.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at the Improv, and I was terrified. I mean, the Improv, real professional grown-up comedians work there. What the hell am I doing at the Improv? But it was part of a thing that Rob does called Talkin' Tunes, and he gets people who do voiceovers for animation to get up on stage with him. And of course, the place was filled with fans. It was a salute to Transformers that night. And I had a ball. And I thought, boy, what if I wrote a monologue and then I could book myself in places and do the monologue and then after that take questions from the audience? Wouldn't that be great? So I started to write this monologue and it got completely out of hand. And I realized, at a certain point, I either had the world's longest monologue or shortest book, and that I had to make some kind of a decision. And then it was, could I possibly write a book? And a year later, the answer was yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. 40 or 50 plus years, folks, condensed down into almost 570 pages of a book. That's a feat.
Well, it's funny. People say to me who have read it, boy, you had a lot of interesting stuff happen to you. And I thought, I kind of did. And yet if you had approached me before I wrote the book and said, have you had a particularly interesting life? I probably would have said, no, not really, compared to most people. But you start to sit back and think about it, and all the wild stuff that happened to me over the years and all the different things that I've done, it has been kind of interesting. And as you say, it's well over 50 years now.
Right.
And of two wonderful passions that chose me, the first being radio and me becoming a disc jockey and production guy, and then the second was, of course, voiceovers.
Mm-hmm.
Which again chose me. I did not choose it. And when I say it chose me, I mean it's more than just, geez, I think I'd like to do that. It's I was anyway seized with this uncontrollable passion, this mad desire, first to do radio and then 20 some years later to do voiceovers. It was something I absolutely had to do. I don't care what the obstacles were. They had to be overcome somehow. I had to be in these businesses because they had chosen me. And I'm very grateful that they did.
Yeah, listening to the radio career part, because I didn't know everything about the voiceover part, but I know a lot of stuff that you've been in because I've watched pretty much all of it. But the radio part really fascinated me because there's one part in the book where you talk about moving away and not being able to listen to KFWB potentially, like if the signal didn't catch from LA to San Diego or something. And I'm like, well, that's just like me when I moved from, sadly, from Boston, Massachusetts to Louisville, Kentucky 20 years ago now. You know, I knew I couldn't listen to any of my Boston stations because there was no way to do that. And I'm like, oh, God, I really miss that stuff. So I knew when you were telling that part of the book, I knew exactly what you were feeling in that moment. With, you know, the whole concern of, can I actually listen to this or not?
Well, I should explain, you know, rock and roll was in its infancy. I had really only just discovered it a few years previous. And I get to Los Angeles, and suddenly out of nowhere, there's this amazing radio station. Suddenly goes, I mean, they'd been on the air, but doing other stuff. But suddenly they were there. They were playing the top 40 with really exciting, vibrant disc jockeys and a wonderful format with all kinds of crazy gimmicks. And I mean, I just... for all I knew, that was the only station in the world like that. And the old man says, we're moving, and do I have any questions? And the only question I could think of, the only thing I cared about at that point was, what, can I still hear KFWB, where we're going? And he looked at me, you know, you half-wit. Yeah, I guess so. You know? it really, that's all I cared about at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, growing up in Boston, it was 105.7 WVBF with Lauren and Wally in the morning, and that was pretty much the only station I listened to half the time. And it was more for the show than it was for the music. The music was, you know, 80s and 90s pop rock kind of stuff, which is fine, but, you know, it was more for what the morning show was doing than anything else.
Sure, sure, well... Of course, you're the FM generation. The when I was doing my radio, the big station in Boston would have been WRKO, I think, the AM.
Yep.
Boston radio, but yeah. You know, it's going back to the 60s.
I think it was AM 680 WRKO.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. I used to listen to Paul Harvey on that all the time.
Good day. That's my Paul Harvey.
I'm surprised you actually didn't even mention, not that you had to, you didn't. I don't think you had any interaction with him, but I'm really surprised with all the radio stuff you've done that you hadn't even mentioned him in the book or anything. Because, like, the whole time I'm listening to the book, I'm like, I wonder if he's going to pull out a Paul Harvey impression at some point.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a buddy who was, actually, he did news on my show down in San Diego, and to this day, when we talk on the phone, as the call is ending, he'll say, well, good day, and I'll say, good day, and we'll hang up. I finally found out why Paul Harvey did that, which I found fascinating. He had to be off the air at exactly 12:15. He had to... split the black, as we say in radio. That's the big dot at the top by the 12.
Right.
The second hand had to be in the middle of that black rectangle when he went off the air. And so what he would do is he would do his kicker story at the end, the comedy story usually.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see him, once you knew what he was doing, you could figure out how it was going down. Because he would get, he would maybe have 20 seconds still to go on the air, and he was a little early, so he would repeat the setup to the joke. The lady says to the clerk, the lady says to the clerk, the lady says to the clerk, I already have a dog. Paul Harvey, good day. And that's, he split the black. And you could hear him feeling the timing. Oh, I got to pad a little bit because I'm early.
Yeah. That's so funny.
Repeat his setup line three times and chuckle. he was a character. I mean, I never met the man, and you know, but he sort of the sound that he had was perfect for AM radio back in the 50s, which is really when he got rolling, I think. Because you picture some guy in a barn, and he's got this crappy old radio that he inherited from his father, and it's all staticky, and he's baling hay. And a guy who talks like an FM announcer, he's not going to hear him.
Mm-hmm. But it's Paul Harvey, his voice cut through all that static and all that noise, and you could hear every word he said. And that whenever I would hear him, I would picture some farmer somewhere with a battered old radio who had kind of stopped his chores for 15 minutes to listen to Paul.
And absolutely.
That's the mental picture that I always got with him. But enough about him.
Yes, more about you.
I find it interesting that you've kind of had that passion for speaking, whether it's through radio or through voiceover, since you were very young, which I can kind of relate to that, because I used to also record myself into a tape recorder and never really much thought about it, and eventually like ended up doing podcasting like this. Mm-hmm. Which is much easier to get into than say radio, which I've not had the joy of working in at any given point. But I found it interesting your journey through starting at that point, through actually getting into radio, and then the how it evolved over the years.
Yeah, as I say in the book Vocal Recall, A Life in Radio and Voiceovers, details coming at the end of this podcast, boys and girls. yes, I started out, I would listen to the radio a great deal. We didn't have television, but the radio that I heard was very varied, the kind of radio that just doesn't exist today. We got the best of the United States. I was in Canada at the time. We got the best of the United States, the best of Canada, and quite a bit from the BBC in England. And there were comedies, there were dramas, there was all kinds of stuff. And I just found myself sort of compulsively trying to reproduce the various voices and accents that I heard. And then, as I chronicle in the book, this amazing day came when my father brought a tape recorder home from the business where he was working at the time. And in those days, portable home recorders just did not exist. These portable, so-called portable tape recorders, they were the size of a suitcase and very expensive. And he just brought the company tape recorder home for the weekend, and he let me experiment with it. And I recorded the entire funny papers from the Sunday paper. And I cannot describe how interesting it was to hear the playback. Because I really wanted to know, do I sound like I think I sound? Am I doing these things that I think I'm doing? And finally, I could hear a playback, and I more or less am succeeding in making the sounds that I want to make. And as I say in the book, you know, every kid discovers something they like. Some kids build model airplanes, and other guys fool around with electronics. I just sat in my room and more or less talked to myself. But it sort of began this arc that led to the rest of my life and the career that I've had. I just always wanted to reproduce the sounds and accents and voices. It's just always been there.
I remember in 1988, when it was probably 89 or 90, once it eventually came out on VHS at the time, when Back to the Future 2 hit, and I didn't even need, like, yeah, I heard you say it in the book, but I'm like, wait a minute, that's Springer from Transformers announcing at the Biff Tannen Museum. What the heck is going on here? I thought that was hilarious, because I love both, you know, all of us love Transformers, Back to the Future, Die Hard, any of that kind of stuff.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Biff Tannen Museum, dedicated to Hill Valley's number one citizen and America's greatest living folk hero, the one and only Biff Tannen. Of course, we've all heard the legend, but who is the man? Inside, you will learn how Biff Tannen became one of the richest and most powerful men in America, Learn the amazing history of the Tannen family, starting with his great-grandfather, Buford Mad Dog Tannen, fastest gun in the West. See Biff's humble beginnings and how a trip to the racetrack on his 21st birthday made him a millionaire overnight.
Yeah, that was an odd... an odd thing for you to suddenly flash on, but it's funny. As I say in the book, there's no big story to go with that. I don't think I even auditioned to be the voice of the Biff Tannen Museum. I think I was just booked, and I don't know how they stumbled across me. You know, a lot of the time you just don't find that stuff out.
Yeah.
And I breezed in two or three takes. We got what we want, thank you, and out the door. And then years later, I'm at these conventions, and people come up and shake my hand and say, it's such a thrill to meet someone who is part of the trilogy. And well, a very small part, but...
You should ask them which one, because there's lots of trilogies now.
Well, somehow to them, that's the trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Between that and Star Wars and...
Well, films don't just stop at three anymore, so...
They should.
Some of them sure should, I guess.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Technically, Star Wars started at four and ended at six, and we don't need to really remember one through three. But, yeah.
Yeah, the Star Wars thing is just too complicated for me. I've lost track.
We've spent, a couple of years ago, we spent, including Spaceballs, Mel Brooks' film, we spent 6 hours reviewing Star Wars movies.
Now, Spaceballs, I like.
Absolutely love that movie.
Yeah, that was my favorite line, I don't know why, he comes out of the transporter and he's backwards.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he looks down and he says, "Why didn't somebody tell me my ass was so big?"
Yep.
We're combing the desert. The radar is jammed.
Yeah, absolutely. Throughout the book, folks, Neil gives you, you know, obviously his story, but the stuff that you will learn about this man. If you've only ever seen or heard him in like something like Transformers or G.I. Joe or something like that, I had no idea you did the Academy Awards announcing for the 75th Oscars. I had no clue.
Yeah, well, it's so different. But that's one of the areas where I've been very fortunate. I've been pretty active in almost every phase of voiceover. Some people kind of specialize in mostly just do animation and games. I've been lucky enough to be able to run the gamut. And... there really isn't any reason why you would make the connection, you know?
Yeah.
But, again, that was a lovely, lovely opportunity that, well, I had to read for it, but, you know, it came along and, I was utterly amazed when I got the job. You know, I'm usually, lucky to be a finalist in these things, let alone actually book the gig. But, that was probably the high point of my career. I doubt if I'll ever be involved in anything that big again.
Well, you've gone on to do, like, the Emmys and other things like that as well. Who knows? Maybe they'll ask you back. I mean, let's hope. I mean...
You never know. They could all go mad and...
I know what to do. Let's get that guy again.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's crazy when... you were talking about all these different roles that you've had the chance to portray over the years, whether it was the announcer roles or the video games. And I've either watched or played a lot of these. And so it was kind of interesting to discover that it was your voice I was hearing throughout these things and not even really knowing it. Although it wasn't like a lead role as far as like some of the games like Mass Effect with the Kodak or like Command and Conquer and things like that, which I've played all those ad nauseum. But I didn't realize that you were so entrenched in all these different areas before listening to you recall it in the book.
Well, voiceover, generally speaking, at least for us plain rap guys, as I call us, and gals, it's there really are no stars, per se. obviously stars are now doing voiceovers, but I'm not talking about them. I'm just talking about us regular folks. And we're almost like a repertory company, you know? Well, all right, this week you get to play Hamlet, but then we're doing King Lear, and we really only need you to play, you know, third page from the left in that one. Oh, okay, fine. You know, sometimes you have the lead, sometimes you're just doing a few lines on the side. It's, you know, we just show up and do what's asked of us and do our best, and I can't complain. It's been a hell of a ride.
Yeah.
Your career has just been so amazing. After listening to and reading through the book, like, you've essentially done everything there is to do in entertainment.
I hope not. I hope there's something.
I mean, yeah. Like, all the different, like you said earlier, narration, animation, the radio stuff, the announcing stuff for the Oscars or the roller derby, or you've been in every facet of it at this point.
Pretty much. I did not devote a chapter to it in the book because I just didn't do it enough. I was never that successful in promos or movie trailers. You know, I've done a few, but, you know, of course, a lot of the guys who do promos, that's all they do.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'd want to spend my life just every day coming in and essentially doing the same thing. You're just plugging in a different show and some different names, but the thing is, the read is always the same, you know.
Yeah.
Tonight on NBC, it's another. It's like, and there are some folks who that's all they do all day long, 5 days a week, and I don't know that I would enjoy that, as lucrative as I'm sure it is. So I really didn't feel that I had done enough in the promo trailer world to be able to even write authoritatively about it. Someone else will have to do that. That's probably the one area that I don't cover in the book.
Yeah, there's one movie voice that there, in my personal opinion, will only be one movie voice. May the man rest in peace, Don LaFontaine. Because that guy could do anything with a trailer.
Yeah, he was, I'm not in any way belittling his talent. He had a marvelous voice, but he also knew how to use it. And what a lot of people, I didn't even know this, but I think the big secret to his success was, long before he started voicing these things, he was writing and producing them using other talent to voice them.
Right.
And so when he picked up a piece of copy, he would scan it and he would understand what they were trying to impart, because he had written these things. He had produced these things. He knew exactly what was needed. And that's what made him, in my opinion, so unbeatable, was those years that he spent writing and producing these things. And so that he understood the concept organically. He wasn't just trying to get a job or, you know.
Right.
He really understood what was going on. And that's what made that, coupled with that extraordinary voice, made him he pretty much, there was a period of time where I remember somebody once came to my house and the wife said, "Oh, you're in that business. You'll know. What's the deal with the guy who does all the movie announcements? I mean, he does them all. Is that a government job or something?" she couldn't understand why only one guy did all the announcements. And I said, "No, he's just very good. They all want to hire him. It's not a government job."
Yes, President Reagan hired Don LaFontaine. When you talk about the breaking into the voiceover, like, I love hearing those types of stories, because it not only gives us insight into not necessarily how to break in, because it's a very hard business to break in, but like what it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, like, And it doesn't seem like you said in the book, it was a hard door to kick down back then, and I'm sure it's an even harder door to kick in now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was difficult then, it's difficult now. It's just difficult now for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
As I point out in the book, when I started out, it was a very small group of people. And they were very firmly entrenched, and it was really tough to break in. Now there's the problem you have is there are thousands and thousands of people doing it or trying to do it. And
the reason is that there's all these people is because of technology. Because as you said in the book, you know, when you were sending in auditions, you were sending in audition tapes, audition CDs, audition that, audition this. Whereas nowadays you can just send an MP3 to an agent or to the buyer or whoever it's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, the producers, and it's all done electronically now.
Yeah, that had a big the digital thing changed the business immensely. It essentially you had to physically be in Los Angeles or New York to work in voiceovers. That's no longer true now. It's no longer true for certain things. In the world of animation and games, they still want you physically in a studio.
Yeah.
You can't MP3 that. I suppose all bets are off if it's a celebrity and they say, well, I'm just not available to come into a studio. Oh, okay, then we'll fly to wherever you are and we'll bring a tape recorder. We'll do whatever we have to do to get you because you're so wonderful. But they're not going to do that with us. They want us in a specific studio. So I think if one wanted to do animation and games, one would have to bite the bullet and move to L.A. But for a lot of the other stuff, no, you can do it from anywhere in the country. No problem.
Yeah, there's only, I'm sure there are plenty other celebrity voiceover scandals out there. But the only one I remember is how self-important Chris Rock thought he was.
in what project?
I don't even remember what project it was, but
It
was a few years ago that somebody had gotten cast, and then the director or whomever it was, I don't even remember who it was, but somebody had gotten cast, and then they got recast because Chris became available, and he said something about, oh, I can do voiceover now because I'm whatever it was that he said. But it was one of those, it was like 4 or 5, 6 years ago, it was one of those things where it was like, really? You think you can do voiceover now? All these other people that have been doing it for the last 30, 40, 50 years beg to differ.
Well, some people manage, but, you know, it's a little bit of a different animal.
Yeah.
And advice to any celebrity who's contemplating doing it, find a good coach and take some lessons. Because your face is not going to be there for you. Your body language is not going to be there for you. The only thing you are able to contribute is your voice. And you have to put a little extra in there. And, you know, as I said, some people, in the book I mentioned Robin Williams. And I say, well, you know, if Robin Williams had never been a big star, he would have been one of the top voiceover talents. He would have, you know, he would have been right up there with Welker. So I had absolutely no problem with Robin Williams, any of the stuff he did. He was brilliant. He more or less made those movies. But some celebrities, they just don't quite get it.
Yeah.
And well, you know, I mean that ship sailed and
it's
what it is. You can't fight City Hall.
You can, but sadly most people try to end up losing. So how many titles did you go through before you settled on Vocal Recall?
Well, that's funny. I started thinking about titles, and I solicited the opinion of many people, and anybody suggested anything, I wrote it down. I had this huge page of titles. And somewhere along the line, I dreamt up Vocal Recall, and I wasn't that thrilled with it, but I wrote it down. And then I just sort of started eliminating all the other suggestions for all kinds of different reasons, and I suddenly realized, well, all that's left at this point is Vocal Recall, so I guess that's it. And my greatest fear was that I would publish the book, and 2 weeks later, the real title would occur to me. It would be too late. But that hasn't happened, so I guess I'm stuck with it.
There you go.
No, I think it's a great title.
It's an amazing title.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
Not necessarily with...
Gone with the Wind, but somebody told me it's taken.
Creative Commons.
Exactly. There are times where that I love being able to reference a title, and I think you even say in the book, well, this is my Vocal Recall. Mm-hmm. And I love being able to do stuff like that, because it's just, hey, poking fun at this is what it's called kind of thing. It's an amazing title, and not only was it an amazing read, it's an amazing listen. You did such a good job on this.
Oh, thank. Well, I won a highly competitive audition to get that part.
Yeah, you only had to beat out Frank Welker and Peter Cullen.
There you go. I couldn't afford either one of those guys. I tell you, that's work. My hat's off to people that narrate books. That's hard work. I almost fired myself 3 times. That's a long haul, man. I don't think I'll voice another book. It's just too much work.
Hey, if you're gonna do one, do your own.
Exactly.
That's the only reason I got through this thing, was that I wrote it, you know. Otherwise, some other stooge had written this, I would have quit around chapter 7.
It's funny you say this, because I can only listen to audiobooks when it's done. Like, I can't do the fiction audio, but like the autobiographical stuff and things like that, I can only listen to it if the person that actually does it, that has written it, or the person that it's about actually does the audio, because it takes me out when somebody else reads that person's, like, it just takes me out of it.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I can kind of see what you're saying, although in some cases, how do you, well, I suppose it says so on the packaging, or
yeah,
how do you even know it's not that guy or gal?
Well, in a particular instance, I'll say, because I know what the singer sounded like. There was a singer from a famous 80s band that I love that had done a book, and it goes between him narrating and his ghostwriter narrating, which is fine. I got used to it after a while, but at first I thought it was just going to be the singer doing the narration, and that's not the case. It is what it is. We all have our different listening preferences and things like that. Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say, one of the stories that kind of resonated with me a little bit too was the discussions on Wally Burr in the recording studio. And the reason I bring this up is because a number of years ago you were at TFCon 2012 and in Mississauga, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to actually be there. So I met you, Wally, Scott McNeil, and it was funny when we were doing the casting call for the where people could read the little script that was the comic that was written for the convention. Mm-hmm. And Wally was up there trying to voice direct everybody. Mm-hmm. And managed to put the entire thing behind schedule trying to voice direct everybody, every fan that went up there to try and voice characters. And they were like, okay, we got to, you know, limit it to one at a time here, you know, because we were like almost out of time and we hadn't even started yet.
Yeah, Wally, he couldn't help himself. He it became a session to him. And he got these poor people and, you know,
now here's what I want, and this and that.
And I'm looking at this poor person, and they have this deer in the headlights look. And Wally is loading them up with direction. And, they had come and they said, well, you only have 10 minutes, so don't, one or two criticisms and move along. And he just do it. He bless his heart. 2 seconds in, and it's a real session for him, and he's got to have that read.
Yep. There ain't no session like a Wally Burr session.
No, that's true. That's true. And heaven knows I sat through enough of them.
But yeah, I mean, it was just humorous. When you were discussing that in the book, I was just thinking back to that time that I actually witnessed, like a brief snippet of what you would have had to go through on a daily basis. So it was just interesting to me.
Well, a promoter came up to me after that and he said, you know, I've had a lot of you actors come to these things and you've talked about what it's like to be directed by him. We thought you were exaggerating, but obviously you weren't. finally got to see Wally in action. It's like, you guys aren't kidding.
Yeah, it was very humorous though to sit there and kind of watch, and you were kind of poking fun at the process too, just because it, you know, like I lived this.
Well, I have to say, I always want to point out that Wally, you know, could drive you crazy, but he was so fiercely loyal to us actors. I mean, if you came in and did a good job for him, he remembered. And he would have you back. And he helped us with our auditions. I mean, I got a lot of jobs that I never would have gotten without Wally's help. And so I always try to remind people that at heart he meant well. He wanted a good quality product. And
18 hours later, you have it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, of the many, 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 many shows that I did over the years, the two that people seem to still remember and build conventions around and still revere to this day are shows that he voice directed, G.I. Joe and Transformers. And he would be more than entitled to say, maybe it was all worth it, fellas, because these are the shows they remember.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell he put his heart into it, even, you know, between the shows and at the conventions when he would appear. You could tell.
Yeah, he was a very sincere guy. He wasn't doing what he did to be mean or abusive. He wanted the best, and he just wouldn't settle for anything less. And
which is a good quality to have.
You know, and sometimes you'd get mad at him, but it wasn't because he was a mean guy. It was because he wanted the best. So you kind of have to forgive him in the end.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly.
Absolutely. That's like, you know, whenever I edit stuff now, you know, people are like, oh, you should have this done within an hour, 2 hours. I have to listen to every single beat and figure out where I can razor and where I can't, or where I should trim this or trim. Like, it take for an hour and a half show, sometimes it takes me 2 or 3 hours just because I listen to every single thing. Like you said before, and like you say in the book, yes, the joy is in the performance, not the playback. But for me, I don't. And the point of that quote is you were talking about in the book how you don't really listen back to anything that you've done. Once I've edited it, because I listen to it as I edit it, I don't actually listen to it after I've published it online.
Hmm.
I just can't, because I already know it by heart. You know, you can ask Steve. People ask me, hey, what was that episode of TuneCast, one of our other other podcasts? Well, which episode was that? And I'm like, episode 67 was USA Cartoon Express, Cartoon Network Express, or whatever it was. I'm like, that sounds about right. Like, I'm one of those guys that I can commit almost everything to memory of that I've done or that I have planned out. It's just, I don't know. I'm strange that way, I guess. Okay, so you've got the book out. You've got it on your website. Is it actually going to be in stores as well, or is it just on your website?
Well, it's going to be sold via the internet. Okay. There may be, at some point down the line, it may end up in stores, but for the time being, you have to order it. I have a website dedicated to the book. If you decide to get a print copy or a Kindle, you click on it, it will send you over to Amazon, and they'll take care of it there. If you want a PDF or audiobook, click on that and you go somewhere else and get those. But the main website to go to for the book is www.neilbook.com, NEILBOOK.com. And you go there and all will be well.
Absolutely. Are you going to do a tour for this at all, or are you just going to let it be out there for everybody to explore it themselves?
Well, I'm doing a number of podcasts, and of course I'm going to be doing conventions.
Okay.
I'm going to do the LA Comic Con next weekend.
Oh, very cool.
Nice.
I'm going to actually physically have some books with me there.
Cool.
Conventions further afield, unfortunately I can't lug books with me, but what I can do, if people are interested, is I can give them an autographed book plate, and then they can write down their name and address and email, and when I get back to LA, I will have the book shipped to them, and then they take the book plate, which I've already given them, and put it in the book, and they have an autographed copy.
Very cool.
So we'll see how that goes. I'm sort of playing this by ear and
yeah,
trying not to be obsessed with how many books have I sold.
Yeah, but you really can't not obsess over that. It's like us with podcasting. How many downloads do we get this week? How many didn't we get this week? You know, it's like everybody obsesses over the numbers at some point.
Sure, sure. Well, I did not write this book for the money.
Oh, I can clearly tell that you didn't do that. So
yeah. I didn't write this book to make money, and so far my plan is working perfectly. But if you go to the website, www.neilbook.com, you will see that should there be any profit from this book, it will all be donated to the Broadcasters Foundation of America and the Actors Fund. So even if I do end up making money, I won't make money off this book.
Yeah, it's one of those things where once you have a project that you're invested in that essentially is your own life story, it'd be great to make a buck off it, but that's not why you do it. You do it for the enjoyment of getting it done and having it out there for all the millions of people that have paid attention to your career at one point or another, whether it's people that listen to you on the radio, whether it's people that like us that, you know, saw and heard you in Transformers and G.I. Joe and all of that stuff. Like, I've been podcasting almost 10 years now, and have I gotten donations and gifts and certain things like that over the years? Yes, absolutely. However, I don't get an hourly or a pay scale wage for this at all. We do this, I put my own time, Steve puts in his own time, all of the other people that work with us on our network put in their own time, and we don't get, you know, an hourly wage or anything like that. And honestly, I probably wouldn't want one, because then it would really feel like a job, and it's like, oh crap, I really have to do this now.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Well, and I think too, aside from monetary considerations, in a way the book is summing up. I mean, I've reached an age now where stuff happens. I've had to say goodbye to some longtime friends, and they were younger than I was, or younger than I am. And so I thought maybe now is the time to kind of sum up everything that's happened to me and put it down on paper or digit. And let people read it.
Absolutely. It's not only is it an engrossing read, it's a wonderful listening experience, because it's just one of those things where you can listen to the book and hear you tell your story and how fascinating that story is from, you know, like I said, the time in radio, the time, you know, you were living in Canada, moving from Canada to California, you know, all of that. I believe in it at one point, I think it was in California, you had mentioned something about apartments were for rent for like $75 back in the day or something like that.
Yeah, that was from an air check of an old friend of mine named Mel Hall when he was on Radio Cadio, Channel 90 Wonderful in San Diego. And this air check is, I believe, from 1960. And the commercial's on there. Yes, there's an apartment complex in La Mesa, and you can rent apartments there for $75 a month. And I don't know what an apartment in La Mesa would run you now, but I suspect it's considerably more than $75 a month.
Yeah. And the other part about the book that I love is when you talk about, you know, commercials and infomercials and all of that, how they've changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And how now they seem more robotic than they used to. There's only one ad that I've absolutely loved in the last 5 or 6 years, and it was for something in Louisville. I'm in the Chicago area now, but it was something in Louisville, Kentucky, for a website that, it's a job hiring website, like Career Builder or something like that. It's called LouisvilleHelpWanted.com. They did an ad campaign where they had this guy who came in and was really, really annoying, and the whole point of the job was, don't be like Dave. Go to Louisville Help Wanted. If I had that audio, I'd send it to you just so you could listen. Because to me, it was so funny, and I hadn't heard a funny radio ad in at least 10 years.
Yeah, they're few and far between. It almost sounds like, well, how many words can we cram into 60 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I remember, as I say in the book, there was this sort of golden age of the radio commercial. And there were these places in Los Angeles where they would write and produce wonderful, wonderful, entertaining radio commercials. And that's all gone now, unfortunately.
Absolutely. All right, so you can go to neilross.com. You can go to neilbook.com. Both links will be in the post for the interview. Anything else you want to impart with our listeners before we let you go for this time around?
Well, let me think. I can. There's a couple of things. I'm going to be at the Retro Toy Con in Greenville, South Carolina, in November. You might want to look that one up if you think you might be in the area. And I checked with them, and it's okay to talk about it. I'm in a new game that's coming out, Rage 2. There was a Rage, and now this is Rage 2.
In which I play Dr. Kvasi, who I guess he tells the player what to do and how to do it and that sort of thing.
So that will be rearing its pretty head in the spring, as I understand it. So those are a couple of things to watch for.
Very cool, very cool.
Very cool.
Where can the people interact with you online if you'd like to give that information?
I'm available via email at neil@neilross.com. I haven't done any Twittering or Instagramming or any of that stuff. I can't figure any of it out.
Don't feel bad. I still can't figure out Instagram. I get Twitter, but beyond that, I'm kind of stuck.
I refuse to use Instagram or Snapchat or any of that stuff. I just refuse. Twitter and Facebook is pretty much all I need. And I'm less on Twitter now than I was 5 years ago, so.
I'm on Facebook, and I would a little tiny bit of advice. If somebody wants to friend me, don't just send me a friend thing, because I don't know who you are. Send me a message saying why you want to be a friend, and you know, maybe I will friend you. But just sending me a friend notice, that automatically goes to delete. Because I know
the trash.
You could be an axe murderer. What do I know?
that's not good. All right. We'd like to thank Neil Ross for taking the time to chat with us. We will ask you to hold the line, and we'll be back after this, folks.
Nobody would listen to an uncharismatic bore like you.
Huge thanks to Neil Ross. As always, go check out neilbook.com, folks, for Vocal Recall.
I got lucky with the Transformers movie. My characters Hook, Slag, and Bone Crusher only had a line or two. But I had landed a new role a few months earlier, a character named Springer. Springer was in a number of climactic scenes in the movie and was given a fair amount of dialogue. The other new characters were voiced by celebrities who were replaced later by us regular folk for the TV episodes. I was lucky they didn't give Springer to a celebrity.
A green Autobot triple changer who can transform into both a car and a helicopter, Springer is the archetypal action hero. He's great in a fight and is always ready with a deadpan sarcastic quip.
Springer also appears to have a thing for female robot RC. Fans often ask if the relationship was ever, shall we say, consummated. I always assure them that a gentle robot never discusses that sort of thing. Besides, how the hell do robots consummate anyway?
And get the audiobook because it's even better listening to it as it is reading it. We will catch you next time here on the GeekCast Radio Network.
Rodimus, look who's back!
Yeah, good to have you back, Springer.
Well, don't let your enthusiasm overwhelm you.
Sorry. I've been thinking about the Quintessons, who they are, why they treat us as enemies. From what I saw back on that asteroid, I think the answer may be in the Matrix, in the memories of the ancient Autobot leaders.
So, just get blasted again and almost die. Then you can enter the Matrix and find out for sure.
He's only kidding. But tell him you're only kidding.
He knows, RC. He's not as dumb as he looks. Come on, let the boy cogitate if he wants. He won't do anything rash, will you, Rod?
To this day, I'm never very anxious to hear my own stuff. The joy for me is in the performance, not the playback.